Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Did you know that the burkini was fashioned by a Lebanese-born Australian fashion designer who has specialised in designing sportswear for Muslim women? Ahida Zanetti, I think that's an Italian surname, launched the Ahida brand in 2004 with a sportswear series that included a full-length swimsuit, which she called the burkini. Its popularity had gone way beyond the Muslim community, with Zanetti estimating that around 40% of her client base was non-Muslim. In Australia, some lifeguards are wearing red and yellow versions of the burkini designed by Zanetti. In recent months, the burkini has been the focus of controversy, with a number of towns in the south of France banning them from beaches, though at least one of these bans has been overturned by France's highest administrative court. Our next guest believes that such bans will only serve to subjugate Muslim women. On the line now to tell us more, we have Dr. Ruja Vazeli, the lecturer in Islamic civilizations at Trinity College Dublin. You are very welcome to the show, Ruja. How are you?
Thank you, Ronan. I'm good.
Now, first of all, Ruja, do you think the burkini has given more women the opportunity to get involved in outdoor sporting activity?
Well, you actually mentioned burkini's designer Ahida Zanetti, and I think it's actually good to kind of to go back to the origins of burkini, which doesn't go back to 1,400 years ago, but back to 2004.
Sure, yeah.
And you know, and she herself said, she said, "I created the burkini to give women freedom, not to take it away."
Right.
So she said that this does not symbolize Islam, but it symbolizes leisure and happiness, fitness and health. And it was something that she designed for her niece to be able to both wear the hijab and play her sport. So looking at it from its origins, it's clear that burkini was invented as a way of including Muslim women in sports and in a way of bringing them into the public sphere rather than confining them.
Yep. Sorry, go on, please. Yeah.
Yeah, in general, like burkini, headscarf, or any other forms of women's covering, you know, they're not subjugating in of themselves. They become subjugating when force is involved. So this be it force veiling in Saudi Arabia and Iran, or force unveiling, as we saw it on the beach in Nice, France last month.
Yeah, exactly, and it was such an incredible story. I found it fascinating because it seemed to have the feminists got involved because they were like, who are you to tell people to cover up or not to do anything and how they want to behave? On the other hand, people were it seemed to me, at least in France, hard for us to kind of understand it, but they seemed to get very exercised about the fact that people were covering up on the beach in France.
Yeah,
and I was surprised when we heard it, we were like, nobody's going to support that, and yet loads of people did. It was really a very, very interesting kind of little picture of life in France today in some ways.
It was, and it shows that, you know, apart, like this was, I suppose, the tip of iceberg. It just shows that there is a lot France is dealing with and needs to deal with.
Yeah. Ruja, can you tell us about your own mother and her experience of swimming in the Caspian Sea?
Yeah, sure. You know, if my mom would probably be able to tell her story much better than I can, but I'll do my best. My mom's experience goes back to the 1960s, growing up in north of Iran as a teenager. So at that time, there was the Pahlavi dynasty, and you know, there was no forced veiling, and you would have had tourists coming to the Caspian Sea who would have worn swimsuits and bikinis, the women.
Sure.
But her experience is interesting because, you know, she was a local girl, and she actually we come from, like, my grandmother and grandfather would be, you know, spiritually kind of traditionalist Muslims.
Okay.
So I, you know, my grandfather would have been quite harsh on my mom and how she dressed in some ways, but she was kind of a taboo breaker, and she would run around with the neighborhood boys and girls, and they would go swim. And so she recalls, she was telling me this memory that, you know, they used to swim with boys, and the boys were in trunks, and the local girls, including my mom, they would swim in their t-shirts and trousers.
Okay, so there was still a kind of a sense of covering themselves.
Yeah, it was, she said, you know, it was easier for her because it was kind of, you know, it was almost natural. Like, they run around, it's hot, they get into the water, they swim up to some place.
Yeah.
And part of it is as well kind of the sense of modesty and
yeah, exactly,
what traditionally you're used to, because like one part of her her kind of memory she vividly calls recalls these men walking around and being very distracted by women in bikinis because
yes.
they weren't used to that. The Tehrani
Absolutely,
women used
yeah.
to come. And obviously all of this changed after the 1979 Islamic Revolution when there was forced veiling and segregation in place.
Yeah, exactly. So I suppose you would say she was observing the kind of the spirit of the law up until that point and trying to, you know, kind of, as you say, the modesty, trying to deal with that in her own way. And yet, I suppose once the kind of the much harsher laws came in, you kind of were kind of to some degree forced to behave in a particular way.
Well, you were forced, not to some degree.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So how did you feel when you read about the pronouncements of these, you know, these administrators, the mayor in Cannes and other places in the south of France? You know, you as a Muslim lady, you're looking at it from a certain remove. But what kind of stirred within you when you heard about that you know, the police going up to women on the beach saying, you know, strip down a bit, you know?
I am Muslim, but kind of more culturally so in some ways, because it's funny, you know, what identity is when you just said Muslim woman there.
Sorry about that.
Because, you know, I think about it probably more in an academic way, but in this sense, I actually, you know, what affected me most was the photo of the woman on the beach in Nice.
Yeah.
Because that really had an impact on me. I looked at that and I nearly burst out in tears because it reminded me of the moral police in Iran. You know, there were two men standing over this woman, the policeman, asking her to remove some items of clothing. And this reminded me of these big petrol, like, you know, the Jeep Land Rover cars that the Iranian moral police went around in.
Wow.
And asked women to fix their headscarves. And at time, they were arrested. We all had some sort of, you know, I came to Ireland when I was 12, but even by the age of 12, I had some encounters with them.
Really? Even at that age?
Even at that age, yeah. You have this fear, you know, every time you see them, you kind of cover your hair. You know, in Iran, you don't cover your face, but it's covering the hair. And obviously, like, there are all these women who wear colorful scarves, and things have changed a lot since the 1990s anyway, because in the 1990s, it was just a few years after the Iran and Iraq war, and it was like very repressive at the time. But that was what I felt. I felt, you know, there are these men who are imposing their will on this woman, and then there were these men in Iran who were imposing their will on us.
In some ways you're saying it's like a reversal of what your mother experienced, and yet at the same time it feels very similar.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of two ends of the spectrum, but you have a common denominators, and it's men and thinking that women don't have their own agency.
Yeah.
And which is not true.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Wearing or not wearing a headscarf doesn't define who you are in some ways.
Can I ask you, and again, you reminded me, and of course you are an academic, but coming from your academic kind of perspective, what kind of impact do you think the criticism of the burkini going to have on, you know, Muslim civilization in countries like France, Muslim women, first of all, in countries like France, but across the kind of Islam as it exists in France? How do you think it's going to work?
Well, see, it's a difficult question, and I suppose the impact is yet to be seen. Mm. But you can anticipate a backlash in more young people who feel isolated, picked on, kind of in academic jargon, othered, may choose some more extremist means of expressing their identities. But, you know, bringing kind of Iran into it again, like if you look at history of Iran, it might be a way of teaching us all a lesson, because in the 1930s in Iran, under the Pahlavi regime, with the first Pahlavi Shah, Mohammad Reza Shah, there was actually forced unveiling because he had this project of modernity.
Okay.
And he was very much influenced by Ataturk in Turkey.
Mm.
And he came back and he basically said, okay, you know, decree forced unveiling. And that actually had a huge backlash, because women who were used to wearing the headscarf as or some sort of veil as part of their identity didn't go out of their houses. So instead of pushing them into the public, it pushed them back into the private. So, you know, things like force banning of an item of clothing could actually have a negative impact in pushing women back into the private rather than liberating them.
Do you know, I was thinking earlier on about what you were saying about polarization and you know, two ends of the spectrum, you know, having something similar in the middle. But can you understand from your perspective, you know, there's been these terrible, you know, terrorist attacks in France and, you know, these Islamist terrorists doing these terrible things, that in some way there is a kind of an internal backlash that political leaders, I suppose, maybe feeling powerless, feel like they need to be seen to doing something. Can you understand that, do you, from your own perspective?
You know, I fully sympathize with questions around security and stopping terrorism. The state is supposed to protect its citizens. But French Muslims are also French citizens. I think the problem in France and really in Europe is, you know, you have the problem of terrorism, but then there is another problem that there is a treatment like of all Muslim as a homogenous entity. Yeah. There is a lot of misunderstanding around that. So targeting head coverings, which is kind of the most visible symbol of Muslimness of some Muslim women, does not secure any state against terrorism. Like, how does regulating a swimwear protect the nation against terrorism?
Yeah, for sure.
And I think, like, we shouldn't forget as well, like, you know, you look at ISIS and other extremist terrorist groups, and they kill more people in Muslim-majority contexts. So in some ways, terrorism is as much problem of Middle East and North Africa as it is in Europe. And within Muslim-majority context, there is a real need at looking at more reformist interpretation of Islam. So, you know, there is a lot of dialogue that needs to happen that then needs to be translated into action.
Yeah, I take your point. It's like, as you quite rightly say, they're ISIS has many, many, many times more Muslim victims than they have, you know, Western victims. Can I ask you a question, Ruja? You know, you've been here since you were preteen, and you've been living in Ireland. Do you think that there's things to be learned from this controversy, you know, here in Ireland? Do you think that we're in danger of going the same road? Do you think it's a very, very different kind of scenario here?
You know, Ireland is very different to France. We don't have that colonial past. Ireland was colonized, but was not colonized.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So in some ways, the Irish history is very different. You don't have, so, you know, in France and in other countries that had colonized Muslim-majority countries, you would have, you know, a higher population of Muslims that are linked to that history. And in Ireland, you know, you started having kind of people from Muslim majority context coming to Ireland, kind of in not in considerable numbers, but like really from 1950s, and then, you know, that has obviously risen to nearly 60,000 now. So it's very different, and they come from very different contexts. There is not that link that, you know, so there's Pakistanis in Britain or Turks in Germany and so on.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
But at the same time, I do feel that, you know, as I said, there is need to have more dialogue to avoid misunderstandings. So that could be seen as the first step, because like a lot of the debate around burkini, I was feeling like there was a lot of misunderstanding there. That homogenizing Muslims all at one. So understanding that diversity, both religious diversity and cultural diversity that the Muslim populations come from is very important.
Yeah, well, let's hope that even this is a start for some of that dialogue and some of that conversation about diversity. Dr. Ruja Fazeli, lecturer in Islamic civilizations at Trinity College Dublin. Thank you so much for talking
to us
this morning.
Thank you.
God bless you. Bye bye.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.